Hi, you're listening to New Books in Political Science on the New Books Network. My name is Ryan Riley, and today I'm speaking with Aaron Leipart. He's professor emeritus at the University of California, San Diego, and past president of the American Political Science Association. We discuss his recently updated book, Patterns of Democracy, published by Yale University Press in 2012. The book is a study of 36 countries over the period 1945 to 2010. It measures the extent to which institutions concentrate power or share power, and the consequences that follow for government performance and the quality of democracy. Hi, Aaron. Thanks for joining me.
You're very welcome, Ryan.
I'd like to begin by asking you how you came to be interested in the study of democracies.
Well, Ryan, it happened in a kind of a step-by-step progression. I became interested in the question of what held the society in which I grew up, Dutch society, because there were very deep divisions between religious and ideological groups, basically Catholics, Protestants, or Calvinist Protestants, and secular people. And the theory until that time was that if you have deeply divided society, basically you cannot have a working democratic system. And so I found here an example of a deeply divided society with a democratic system that worked quite well. The basic reason was what has come to be called power sharing. That is to say, when you have a deeply divided society, it's not only political scientists or other outsiders that look at that society and find that there are risks and all kinds of problems involved in such deep division. But, of course, the political leaders and other leaders of the society recognize that as well. And if they want to counteract them, how do they counteract it? Well, basically, it becomes a question of just tolerating each other and just deciding to work together in spite of the disagreements, so that the governments become power-sharing governments in which all of the people are represented. So typically, that kind of society that I found in the Netherlands also would have elections by proportional representation, so that the different ethnic, religious, and linguistic groups, if you have them in a society, can have a representation according to the strength in the society. And so the next step then was, is Dutch society unique? And when I started looking around, I found, no, there are other examples of that. And my next examples that I looked at were Belgium, Switzerland, Austria, and then beyond Europe, I found examples in Lebanon and Malaysia, and so on. Now, without going into all of these specific examples, the basic answer in all of these cases was the idea of mutual toleration if we cannot find complete agreement, and power sharing, trying to live together and govern a society in spite of these differences. Then the next step for me was to think, can we use the distinction between power sharing type of governmental systems and the better known at that time majoritarian systems, where it's simply a question of the majority chooses a government and the majority rules and everybody is out of power. And I started thinking, what are the different institutions that would be used for power sharing on the one hand and majoritarianism on the other hand? And I found, of course, that has to do with the electoral system. Is it a majoritarian system or is it a proportional system? Has to do with the kind of party system that you have. Is it a two-party system, as in Britain, where you typically have a majority party that's in power and a minority party that's out of power? Or is it a government that is a coalition of different parties representing different groups? And so that became the book that I published in 1984, a long time ago, simply called Democracies, which was a comparison of 21 countries, mainly in Europe, but also included the United States and Canada and Australia, New Zealand, Japan, Israel. The next step after that was to draw in more countries, and I published a book in 1999 called Patterns of Democracy, and I just recently published a revised and updated edition of that, still comparing 36 countries. And the main themes of that, and you may have more questions about that, was to point out that when you look at the different governmental institutions, I already mentioned the question of government is the coalition government, one-party government, the electoral system, the kind of interest group system that they have, whether it is federalism, the kind of legislature that different countries have, you find that there's a lot of variation between countries, but there are still patterns, and these things hang together. So, for instance, if you have a proportional electoral system, you're likely to have a multi-party system, you're likely to have coalition government. So these things are not kind of randomly distributed among countries. And so I found that countries can, in fact, be placed on a continuum from the very majoritarian on the one hand to, on the other hand, what I call consensus systems. And there are a number of countries that are in between. And the same thing goes for another dimension of that, is what I call the federal unitary dimension, which is based on the idea of federalism and decentralization versus unitary and centralized government. But then again, the kind of the legislatures that countries have, the kind of court system that countries have, falls into a pattern along the same lines. Go ahead.
You've kind of touched on the main thrust of the book, that different democracies, according to their institutions, can be divided between consensus and majoritarian, or at least they can be placed on that spectrum. Is that right?
That's correct.
That helps bring some simplicity to all the institutions you've been mentioning, or at least helps to put them in perspective.
Right. To get back to your previous question, how did I arrive at this? It was really kind of a step by step. I was looking at divided societies and what kind of democracy did they have. Then I started looking at democratic institutions, and I started trying to map all of this. And basically, the kind of thing that we are just talking about has to do with the fact that at first glance, things look very complicated. It looks like there's so many differences between different countries. But in fact, if you try to categorize these things, a much simpler pattern emerges.
Right. So part of that pattern is what you call the executive parties dimension. And this dimension includes components like the electoral system and the party system. How does this help us understand the patterns that democracies fall into?
The real distinction is between concentration of power on the one hand, concentration of power in the majority versus joint power for all the different groups or for many different groups. So I call that dimension the executive parties dimension because it has to do with characteristics of executive power. And the party system, the electoral system, and the interest group system. So there are actually five characteristics to this which tend to hang together. One is distinction between one-party government versus coalition government, or put it more exactly, kind of like one power, a single power, relatively narrow government versus broad power-sharing coalition cabinets. A second characteristic has to do with executive power. In majoritarian systems, the executive is all important. And think about it all the time. My main example, like almost a perfect example for majoritarianism, is the British system of government. But the cabinet is all important, and parliament is an interesting institution where lots of interesting debates take place. But basically, the government has the support of the majority of parliament and can basically do what it wishes to do. In consensus systems, where there's power sharing, the executive is much less dominant. So I talk there about executive-legislative balance. And in the British type of system, it's executive dominance. And then there's the distinction between the two-party system, with one party being in power and the other party being in opposition in Britain, versus a multi-party system and consensus system. And that, again, has to do with a majoritarian system of elections in the on the majoritarian side and proportional representation on the other side. And with regard to the interest group system, that is the fifth characteristic. The distinction is between on the easier to understand, perhaps on the consensus side, where the different interest groups are, first of all, tend to be integrated into larger confederations, so kind of a large confederation of labor. There's one large employers association, one large farmers association, and then they are tied together in almost like permanent negotiating situation. So that is in the literature, is called a corporatist interest group system, versus, on the other hand, a pluralist interest group system, where there you have a multitude of competing interest groups that are all trying to get the best deal without being coordinated, as in the consensus system. Now, all of these, so on the majoritarian side, I have majoritarian elections, single-party government, a dominant executive, majoritarian electoral system, and a free-for-all interest group system. And those characteristics tend to hang together. So if a country, for instance, you know, is typically has a two-party system, it also tends to have these other characteristics. On the other hand, a country that's a proportional representation and a multi-party system, it tends to have those other characteristics. So again, it's not just like there is a chaos of characteristics. No, these things hang together. And if a country is mainly has those majoritarian characteristics, I call it a majoritarian democracy. If a country has mainly the consensus characteristics, I call it a consensus democracy. Now, what I also do in the book is I quantify and measure all of these variables. So if you have a coalition government or not, I measure over a period of time what percent of time a country has a coalition government versus single-party government. You can measure with regard to the electoral system. There are lots of different electoral systems, but one thing that you can measure is how proportional is in practice the electoral system. That is to say, how much discrepancy is there between the results of an election in terms of votes and the results of an election in terms of seats. And so that determines how proportional the system is. So all of these characteristics can be quantified, and then you can add them up and assign a place to every country that is involved. And in my book, I have 36 countries. All of those can be placed on a continuum between majoritarian democracy on one hand and consensus democracy on the other. So that is one dimension.
Yes.
But do you want me to go into the second dimension?
Right. Well, I already have some questions for you. We've been using the word majoritarian to describe systems in which power is concentrated.
Mm-hmm.
As you note, these majoritarian systems don't always put a majority of the people in power.
Right.
And they've even been called pluralitarian.
Right.
Could you explain word majoritarian and how well you think it describes the reality?
Yeah, I think majoritarian is actually still a good term, because the in majoritarian system, I think again of the British system, which is a good example, both because it is better known to more people than, say, the system of Austria or Norway. And because it is a such a nice and clear example of majoritarian government, it is actually the majorities that you get in parliament are majorities in terms of the seats in parliament. They are not necessarily majorities in terms of the votes or majorities of voters that support the government. So in a way, they are what has been called artificial or manufactured majorities, but the whole system is geared toward getting that majority in parliament, which will then make a single-party government possible, and which also then tends to mean that the executive is the dominant force. And that also requires a two-party system. No, and in fact, the critique of this, and that would also be my critique, is that while the system is geared to manufacture these majorities, it manufactures these majorities out of minorities of the voters. And as I point out in my book, in Britain since 1945, no British government that has supposedly a majoritarian government has actually been supported by a majority of the voters. And the last time that the Labour government was voted into office, I think that was in 2005, The Labour Party won a majority of the seats in Parliament with about 35% of the vote. So in fact, it represented only slightly more than a third of all of the of voters. But the system, the majoritarian system of elections, which is the one that we in America are familiar with, which is the single-member district with the candidate that wins the most votes, wins, even though, you know, the most votes may not be a majority of the votes. And that leads to overrepresentation in general of the majority party, and in some cases, a gigantic overrepresentation, as in the example that I just mentioned, when 35% of the voters, in fact, installed a majority government in London. It can also give rise to, I mean, that's a system that we are familiar with in the United States. It can give rise to actually the party winning a minority of the votes and another party winning more votes, that the minority party actually wins the majority of the seats. That in Britain has happened in only once since the Second World War in 1951, and it gave rise to quite a bit of unhappiness, especially on the part of the losing party, which was the Labour Party, which had won more votes than the Conservatives, but the Conservatives won more seats. In the case of New Zealand, it happened twice in 1978 and in 1981, where the Labour Party won more votes, but the National Party, even though winning fewer votes, got the most seats. And that caused such an uproar in New Zealand that it eventually led to a complete change in the electoral system. And in fact, the shift, a very big shift, to proportional representation. In that connection, I think it's interesting to note that the last House of Representatives election in the United States, also conducted by single-member district plurality system, that the Democrats won more than a million more votes than the Republicans, but of course the Republicans managed to win a majority in the House. And one of the things that surprises me is that there isn't more of an outcry about that in the United States. In the last election, that's the 2012, into the House, it's even more clearly a manufactured majority, manufactured by the Republican Party when they did their redistricting after the census of 2010. They deliberately created districts that they would win with relatively small majorities and letting votes in Democratic districts pile up. And therefore, it's not only a manufactured in the sense that it made a minority into the majority, but the manufacturing was very deliberate. And I'm actually kind of disappointed in my fellow citizens in the United States in that there isn't more of an outcry about it, that it isn't even front page news. And surprising, too, that the Democratic Party doesn't make more out of this. When the Republicans in the House are obstructing what the Democratic president and a Democratic majority Senate want, that they don't keep say, okay, well, you have a majority in the House, but how legitimate is your majority? And in fact, it's entirely manufactured, so don't have such a big mouth.
That's very interesting, and it could be another discussion, and I hope it will be. But
this goes beyond my book.
Right. Although the book is a great way to prepare yourself to appreciate those kind of distinctions. You've answered my question about majoritarian refers to majorities in the legislature.
Right.
Is the same true of the term consensus, that it only applies to what happens in the legislature, or do consensus democracies also enable consensus among voters?
I think that basically, I guess the first alternative is what I would support, because I'm mainly talking about institutions. So that consensus means coalition building. It means having many parties, but that are all drawn into the governing process. It means that interest groups are coordinated and try to cooperate as much as possible instead of just fighting each other and so on. So the question that is, I guess at the very end of the book I talk about this, is what is it just institutions or is it culture? And why do certain societies institute these consensus systems? And I think it has to do with, in fact, consensus systems are instituted in those countries where basic popular consensus is lacking. They are meant to create more consensus where originally the consensus is absent. And so, for instance, the question sometimes I'm asked, if my example of consensus democracy, which is Switzerland, I say, well, but that's easy because in Switzerland everybody is, they have different languages, of course, and also different religion, but basically homogeneous, everything works fine. But in fact, in Switzerland, there have been a whole series of civil wars between the people, and it's only recently that the country has become so peaceful. And why is this? Well, because they went through this process of deciding that they should do something about this lack of consensus and create a consensus type of democracy, and that has led to a greater consensus among the people. I would say still say the same thing about my native country of the Netherlands. Even when I was young, the differences between the different groups of people were still very, very, very sharp. But gradually, these differences have evolved. Mainly because the system was geared to getting different groups to cooperate and giving the different groups a feeling of safety, so they did not feel threatened by the other groups. And as a result, in fact, the basic consensus among the people has improved a great deal in the Netherlands.
So it sounds like while majoritarian systems put a minority in charge, consensus systems enable different groups to be mediated.
Right. I think that's okay. that is correct. And in fact, and that goes back to your earlier question about is majoritarian the right word. Obviously, in these majoritarian democracies, as I've said, it's actually the largest minority often that's in charge. Whereas when you look at the governments in consensus democracies that are coalition governments, and when you look at how many people have voted for the parties that are in the government, that tends to be, in consensus system, at least a majority of the people. So a government that is supported, as in Britain at one point, by just 35% of the people, that would just really be quite unusual, I would say, or even impossible. I don't know any instance of that in a consensus system where a government has such a narrow popular basis.
So consensus groups are actually better at putting majorities of the people in power. Is that right?
That's correct. I think at one point, not in this book, but in an article, I have an article or a chapter that is called "Who Really Supports Majority Rule?" And my answer is, in answer to your question now, in fact, the consensus systems are better at creating actual majority rule.
Let me return to an earlier factor you brought up within this executive party dimension: corporatism and pluralism. You use the word corporatism in a way that has a long history, probably not familiar to a lot of people, at least a lot of people in the United States who think of corporations when they hear the word corporatism. But
yeah.
Could you explain how you're using the word?
Yeah, it just happens to be a term that has become the accepted term in political science. It's often also incorporated with, say, fascist rule. And under fascist rule, all of the interest groups were kind of put under the control of the state, and they were coordinated, but they were not free. There was not a free type of coordination. And in distinction to that, for democratic system, we talk about neo-corporatism or democratic corporatism. A better, perhaps a better descriptive term that would be easier for lay people to understand would be to call it coordinated and cooperative interest group system, as opposed to a conflictual interest group system. And in the typical, the most extreme or the most thorough of these corporatist interest group systems, which you tend to have, and I'm thinking there of the example of Austria, Norway, and Sweden, to some extent Germany, certainly also Holland. Pattern is one in which, first of all, the different labor unions are coordinated with each other, so that you have one large labor union confederation, and similarly, that you have one large group of employer organizations that can speak with one voice, and that can speak for all of their constituents, and that have. Then together with often farmers' associations that meet on a regular basis with representatives of the government to iron out these socio-economic and financial problems. In Holland, there was actually a permanent council called the Socio-Economic Council, which was a body kind of next to Parliament, but just a negotiating body, but quite a powerful body, because when they came up with recommendations, which were then supported by labor unions, by employers, by farmers' organizations, Parliament could still decide otherwise, but usually they would just accept whatever compromise had come out of that. And that is very different from a situation where either these organizations are very weak or not existing at all, and they all just compete with each other, which is more the system as in the United States and in Canada and in Britain. In the United States, of course, there's the AFL-CIO, which is an overarching labor organization, but it's very weak, and it does not do a very good job at kind of bundling all of the labor unions that are associated with it. So it's almost, compared with the similar organizations in Sweden and Austria, it's almost like an empty shell.
So the alternative to corporatism or coordination, pluralism, which you also call competition, but it's competition of a particular kind where labor is the weaker party.
I think that is usually the case. Even though in corporatism too, there are differences in how strong employers are on the one hand, labor unions are on the other hand. In Sweden, for instance, I think the labor unions have to be more dominant. In Japan, specifically, which tends to be on the corporatism side, the employers have tended to have the upper hand. But the most important thing is that the unions themselves, so the separate unions and the separate employers groups, simply try to get as much of an advantage for themselves without really thinking of the interests of other labor unions or other employers or organizations.
So in pluralist systems, not only is there competition between the employers and the unions, but there's competition among the unions. They're not coordinated.
I think that is correct. Either kind of like open competition or competition in the sense that there is no coordination of the demands and interests of the different groups.
Well, perhaps we should move to your second dimension, which is the federal unitary dimension.
Sure. Again, the idea is really, again, just to think of the different institutions in terms of, does this mean a concentration of power? Does it mean, in this case, not so much a sharing of power, but a dividing of power? And so the first thing that comes to mind is in a unitary and centralized system, obviously you have concentration of power. In a federal and decentralized system, you have the division of power, so the opposite of concentration. And then there are other institutional characters that hang together with this. I mean, is the legislature a unicameral legislature in which all power is concentrated in a single house of the legislature, or is it a bicameral system in which there are not only two houses of the legislature, but those two houses have a different composition or elected according to different rules, sometimes have different powers and so on. So that means more, again, of a division of power. Then there's also the question of the highest courts in a country, Supreme Court or Constitutional Court in some countries. How much power is given to those courts? How much separate power is given to those courts? There are countries like the United States which have very strong judicial review, where Supreme Courts are very important separate branches of the government. In other countries, like actually a good example is my native Netherlands, obviously the court system is a separate system, but the courts do not have the power of judicial review. In fact, the Dutch Constitution says specifically the courts are not to test the constitutionality of laws passed by Parliament. So that means more of a concentration of power. If you have courts with very strong judicial power, you have more of a separation of power. Then I guess that's the third characteristic. The fourth characteristic has to do with constitutions and who writes a constitution. Can constitutions be written and amended by a simple majority? That would mean a concentration of power. Or do you need special, extraordinary majorities or complicated procedures to change the constitution? In other words, is the constitution a flexible one, which is majoritarian, or is it a rigid constitution? And then the fifth characteristic has to do with central banks. Are central banks in a country very powerful, and are they therefore, again, a separate source of power, or are central banks, and all democracies have central banks, are they relatively powerless and under the direction of the executive, which would mean a concentration of power? So you have this concentration, again, versus division of power, and these things tend to go together. When countries that are federal and decentralized tend to have rigid constitutions. They tend to have bicameral legislatures. They tend to have central banks that are powerful. Unitary and centralized systems of government tend to have unicameral parliaments, flexible constitutions, and relatively weak central banks. So again, there are lots of possibilities of these characteristics in different countries, but there's also a clear pattern to them. So that again, we can quantify all of these characteristics. We can operationalize them, give numbers to how weak, how strong different institutions are. You can add those up, and you can decide on the whole a country is more on the federal side or more on the unitary side.
I should point out that the book is very empirical. There is a lot of measuring. A lot of the conclusions are arrived at through statistical analysis, looking at quantitative aspects of institution. What did that tell you about which institutions lend themselves more to democracy?
Well, the main part of the book has to do with these basic 10 characteristics. As you say, I spent quite a bit of time explaining how I operationalize and quantify these variables. But I should also say right away for potential readers of the book, I'm not using terribly complicated statistics. It's mainly really quite simple, and in fact, I think it's almost self-explanatory. Even though I think it is useful if one knows a little bit of regression and correlation analysis. But regression and correlation analysis is just about the simplest statistics that one can deal with. And compared with other books in political science, my book, it's all relatively simple. But the quantification helps in terms of putting the whole theory together. Just what I do at the end of the book, the last two main chapters of the book, deal with the question of, I guess I call it the so what question. At that point, the reader might ask, okay, so you have shown that some countries tend to be more majoritarian, more consensual, some are more federal, some are more unitarian, their overall characteristics. That is all very, very nice, and it helps to see patterns in everything. But does it make a difference? And so I ask in the last two questions, does it make a difference in terms of how effective the government is and in certain democratic values? And for both of these questions, again, I use quantitative indicators. For the question of how effective is the government, I can use measures like how much inflation is there, how much economic growth. In other words, how well does a government manage the economy of a country? And all of these are quantitative measures, so we can judge that objectively. There are also, in recent years, there are more and more data available based on expert judgments on, you know, how effective a government is, how much honesty there is versus corruption in a government. All of these are measures developed by other people, which means that I can kind of use them without the possibility of being accused of cooking my numbers. I'm not making up these numbers. I'm just using what other people have already arrived at, or in the case of inflation, unemployment, economic growth, budget deficits, and so on, what the economists and what official government figures show. Now, I should say right away that I'm talking about one of these aspects, which is how effective our governments at governing. I find there that the differences are not enormous, but on the whole, consensus governments do better. Now, let me also say right away that on the other dimension, the federal unitary dimension, I do not find that there are significant differences between countries. I think that for large countries there are advantages in having federalism, decentralization, but it does not have much of an effect on the question of how effectively a government is run.
Right, and then you also look at the quality of democracy.
Yeah, then and I look at the quality of democracy, and again there to say that right away. On the dimension of federalism versus unitary government, I do not find that there's much of a difference. But there I find this really major differences between consensus government and majoritarian government. And consensus government tend to score much higher on democratic values. And again, there are, especially in the last 10 years or so, a lot of measures have been developed about the level of democracy, but we can go look at simple things like voter turnout. I mean, voter turnout is a good measure of quality of democracy, because it when you have a lower turnout, it means that the people in a country are not really interested in the democracy. With a higher voter turnout, it's obviously better from a democratic point of view. We can look at how well minorities are represented, or especially how well women are represented. What degree of inequality is there still in representation between men and women in parliaments and in the government? And on those kinds of measures, the consensus the democracy are just overwhelmingly better than majoritarian systems. So if you add up the two things, effective government, where consensus democracies are at least slightly better, and in terms of democratic quality, they are overwhelmingly better, it's obvious that my choice as to what is the better form of government, it's consensus democracy.
So let me play the devil's advocate and ask you about Italy. How do you respond to those that say the systems of proportional representation are less governable or can lead to the kind of turmoil that Italy is not only experiencing now, but say has experienced for much of the last half century?
Yeah, I mean, Italy is, when you look at it, and actually when you look at quite a few of consensus democracies, it looks like there is a lot of fighting and backbiting, but in the end, they often do come together, and that was true for it in Italy for a long, long time, in fact, there's this an old book written in the 1990s, I think 1980s, 1990s, by a real Italy expert, Joe LaPalombara, who was a professor at Yale University and who obviously had Italian background. And he was saying that all of this fighting is on the surface, and when it comes to making policy, Italy is actually pretty consensual. The Communist Party is kept out of power, but behind the scenes they negotiate with the other parties. And in terms of economic growth, of course, since the Second World War until say about in the mid 1990s, Italy did much better than Britain. Because Britain looks like it's much better governed, but Italy in fact had the better economic growth. Now, if the current situation in Italy is obviously not very good at all, my figures do not include the current situation. I stopped in 2010. Now, if I had pulled it up to 2013, probably not. There wouldn't be all that much difference because I take averages over a long period of time in order to even out, certain changes in certain countries. It's better to look at the long haul. And certainly for a long time, as you said, Italy does not look like it's the best example of a rational, effective government. And you might say the same thing of another proportional representation country such as Israel. On the other hand, they're also I guess if you had been the devil's advocate, you might say, well, perhaps these proportional consensual systems work well because you have the Scandinavian countries in your sample. But then I would say, yeah, I have the Scandinavian countries in there, but there's also Belgium, there's Israel, there's Italy, and so on. So I'm not just using the country that everybody says, those are successful. Those are successful countries. I simply take, and I guess that's just an objective thing, I take all of the countries that have been democratic for a minimum of 20, let's see, do I take that, 20 years, yeah. And then I look at their overall characteristics. So there are some countries that do better, some countries that do not as well, but on the whole, these consensus systems do better. And I think we are often this truth is obscured because people think, and that was the view in political science for a long time, that what you need for effective government is decisive government. And the government that can make decisions quickly, that can make firm decisions, and because the model for that again was Britain. Now the theoretical counter argument to that is yes, I mean, there are advantages to being able to make decisions fast if necessary, and to make firm decisions. But of course, fast decisions are not necessarily the best decisions. Often, it's better not to decide things so fast and to have more discussion and negotiation before you arrive at a final policy. And it's indicative in the case of Britain that one of the really strong prime ministers since the Second World War, Margaret Thatcher, who is often described as the Iron Lady, and who held her members of the cabinet under control and who really controlled parliament, she was undone by one of these fast decisions, the so-called poll tax decision, which is too complicated to explain here, but which turned out to be a disastrous decision. And why was it made so fast? Because she could do it. She had the power. She could do it. She did it, and it turned out to be a terrible decision. It's another reason why countries like Britain and even more the United States do not do as well in terms of the economy, and that is their single-member district elections. And we have that. You have members of parliament representing certain districts in the country, and what they try to do is to get advantage for their districts, which is not necessarily the most rational and effective solution for the whole country. So that, of course, in the United States, we know, too, why are military installations in particular districts? It is because of political pressure and political advantages. Not necessarily the best thing for the country as a whole. So there are real inefficiencies in systems that are decentralized to this kind of extent. Whereas if you have a government that are not so beholden to special geographically concentrated interests, can be more effective and efficient.
You note in the book that these consensus democracies might be the result not so much of any one institution, but rather that these institutions might all be the result of cultures of consensus. What is a culture of consensus? How do you understand that?
I would understand that when there's just a greater kind of homogeneity in terms of interests and feelings among the people. When feelings, especially when you have a divided society, let's say between, as in Switzerland and the Netherlands and Germany, between Catholics and Protestants, when both communities feel that they are safe in the pursuit of their religion, that they do not have to fear being dominated by the other group. It does not mean that everybody thinks the same, but that there's a basic understanding of the rights to be different. And I think that institutions, power-sharing institutions, can help that kind of attitude. And at the same time, when you do find that among the people there is less animosity, less mutual fear, that obviously then makes it easier for the leaders to arrive at compromises, because they don't have to fear the backlash of their voters. So I think culture and structure, or culture and institutions, tend to be mutually related.
If there were one thing that a country could do to promote a culture of consensus, would you have a recommendation for that?
Yeah, I would think one of the things that can be introduced, and in fact some people have said that as political scientists, as political system designers, we can manipulate, is the electoral system. If you start with, there are two things. One is an electoral system of proportional representation, and two is a parliamentary system of government rather than a presidential system of government. If you have those two factors in a country, the country is likely to have consensus institutions. Because proportional representation, if it is, if there are not too many limits to the proportionality, it will mean a multi-party system. It will probably mean coalition government, and it'll mean more of a balance between executive and legislature. So that already helps a great deal. And then also, if it's a parliamentary system where the different parties can form a government that is based on a majority in parliament. In a presidential system, the problem, of course, is that presidential systems, their very nature, are majoritarian elections. There can be only one president can be elected. There's a clear winner, and there are the other candidates are losers. And so you build in some majoritarianism right there. In the case of the United States, of course, that is connected with a two-party system and a majoritarian election system. So if you want to avoid majoritarianism, if you want to introduce consensus, do two things. and that's proportional representation and a parliamentary system of government.
Thank you. We've taken a lot of your time. Before we go, I'd like to ask you two questions, and maybe they're related. The first is, when you looked at this extended period, the original book, you looked at democracy from starting with 1945 to 1996, I believe.
Right.
And in the update, you added the period 1996 to 2010. Has that changed your ideas at all about the direction democracy in the world is going? And the second question is whether you have any projects that you're working on next, because I presume they would have something to do with democracies.
Right. To answer the first question, actually in my book, also toward the end, I asked the question of, I put countries, I label countries as having a certain degree of majoritarian, having a certain degree of federalism versus unitary government, and so on. Over the long period, how have things changed? And what I do for that is to divide that period from 1945 to 2010 into roughly two equal periods, and I compare where countries are before that time and after that time. And on the whole, I find that there is very little change. So these things tend to be, institutions tend to be conservative. You don't change them easily. And you can see that very clearly, especially with regard to the electoral system, because in my 36 countries, how many countries have changed from, say purely majoritarian elections to proportional representation? And the answer is one of those 36, namely New Zealand. And that happened under very unusual circumstances that are too complicated to explain briefly, but basically countries tend to stick. I mean, if a country is a stable, long-lasting democracy, they tend to stick with their institutions. So a whole lot of change, you simply cannot expect. About the future of publication, I am now 76 years old, and I basically decided I'm not doing any major research any longer. But there is a project which has been underway for a long time that is a collaborative project that I'm doing with Bernie Grofman of the University of California, Irvine, Matt Shugart, who is my colleague at the University of California, San Diego, but he has recently moved to the University of California in Davis, Stephen Taylor, who is at Troy University. What this book is all about is actually it started with discussions that I had with Bernie Grofman about my book Patterns of Democracy, and this what we noticed was that when we compare all of these countries, that the country that is the most difficult to fit in terms of the classification is the United States. And the United States just seems to be the most different of these democracies. And we decided to do that in a systematic way and look at all kinds of characteristics of government and ask, where does the United States stand and where do other countries stand? And so we have a book that is going to be called A Different Democracy, and the subtitle, I think it's not quite certain yet, but it's something like American Government in a 31 country comparison. We compare the United States systematically with 30 other democracies, on just a host of characteristics. We're looking at probably hundreds of characteristics. We find that the United States tends to be, in some cases, unique, in very many cases unique, and in almost all cases, at least, unusual. So that, I mean, the idea of it, that this book is what I've always had in mind, is that I would like this book to be used in the introductory course on American government, where students learn about American government, where often the assumption is, of course, you know, we need to learn about American government because we are American citizens. We need to know how our own system works. But also, I think, an unspoken assumption that if we learn about American democracy, we learn something about democracy in general. And we want to kind of disabuse them of that idea, because the United States is, in fact, very different from most other democracies in just as I said, just about every respect. I mean, just mention one example. We are so accustomed in the United States to have primary elections. There are almost primary elections in advance of any general election. Now, how many other countries have primary elections? Well, some countries talk about that, but they are not like the American primary elections. Are elections that are not run by the parties. They're run by the political system. They're run by the government. They're not voluntary. They're mandatory. And they are open to every voter. You don't have to be a formal member of a party. Now, these characteristics of American primaries, we do not find in any other democracy. The United States is absolutely unique in that respect. And so I think we would need another hour to go into lots more detail about that. But the title of the book indicates it. It's called A Different Democracy, and that different democracy is American democracy.
And when can we expect to see that on the shelves?
We have, we're just about to sign a contract with Yale University Press for that book, and I think it should be out by not later than the middle of next year, and I'm actually hoping that it'll be available by, say, about March or April of next year.
Aaron Leipart, thank you for joining me. It's been a pleasure speaking with you.
Pleasure for me, too. Thank you.
You've been listening to an interview with Aaron Leipart on the second edition of his book, Patterns of Democracy, published by Yale University Press in 2012.